welcome to House of Comments. Yes, we're here on a Wednesday, which is revolutionary. It's for various reasons, not least because the four wannabe Conservative leaders have just graced the stage in Birmingham to give their speeches. So you've got some hot takes coming up. Get those oven gloves on because they're going to be the hottest of takes.
Scotchio.
Scotchio indeed. We're going to start, though, as we must, in the Middle East after Iran's barrage of about 180 missiles towards Israel last night. There's lots of stuff we discussed about this last week. I do think it, obviously, we didn't know the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah at that point. That happened later on, after we'd recorded. So that's,
I don't think there'd been boots on the ground in Lebanon either last time we spoke.
Indeed. It's exactly, everything in the north has rather shifted.
Yeah.
And so that's just a big dynamic shift that we wanted to touch on. Obviously, that kind of huge barrage against Israel, thankfully, it doesn't look like it was a success at all. It seems that the only, unfortunately, the only person to die was someone in the West Bank. And the other deaths, it seems, were, I've heard stories of one Iranian missile going wrong in Iran and failing to launch and killing people who were trying to fire it. It was one story I've heard. But anyway, thankfully, Iron Dome and other defensive tactics, including apparently some kind of mobilisation from British troops, helped keep Israeli civilians safe. It's obviously another huge escalation. For me, this felt very different to the time a few weeks ago where Iran, or maybe it was a few months ago, I've slightly lost track of time with all this, but when Iran fired rockets at Israel in response to something else, and that felt a lot more sort of choreographed. They wanted to make the point and be able to tell people that they'd done something. There wasn't the intention, I didn't think, it was all those drones, to do particular huge damage. They just wanted to make the point they were responding. I think last night, Tuesday night, really did have the intention of causing harm and destruction in Israel. And Pat, now, there obviously was not enough rockets, I don't think, to overwhelm Iron Dome. It would take a lot more to do that. But every time things ratchet up, that gets closer. Obviously, the British government responded. I mean, I don't think their response is of any particular relevance, but they did sort of said just about what they had to say. And that's where we are now. It leads to a very tense few days in the Middle East as Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, comes in. And there's obviously, it's a host of Jewish, major Jewish festivals coming up over the next days and weeks. So there's all of that. And of course, October the 7th, the original attack a year ago, the anniversary, took place on the Jewish holiday of Simchat Torah, another significant Jewish holiday. So, well, I fear next time you and I speak on air, there may have been more developments.
Yes. I think there have been developments on both sides since we last spoke. Everybody is ratcheting up. Nobody is stepping back from any brink anytime soon. I think the two most significant developments from the Israeli side were the taking out of the leader of Hezbollah, something I think most people would support. And then the...
Including you?
Of Hezbollah, yeah, absolutely. Taking out an individual is different, I think, than the more widespread and less discriminate targeting that we've seen in other places, which I do have much more of a problem with.
Although, of course, that becomes much harder when terror organisations embed themselves in civilian society.
Yes, but, I mean, there is a problem with, how many lives do you lose to get one terrorist? What is the calculation? What is the end game? What is the ultimate result, both for the security of the Palestinian state and for the security of the Israeli state? All of which lead to more questions than answers, frankly, in my mind than anything else.
We're at a very precarious moment.
We're at a very
we?
Precarious moment. I don't think anyone is making us less precarious, making the situation less precarious. I think I said last week that, again, opening a war on a second front before the war on the first front has reached an end point, always seems a mistake to me.
Well,
just tactically. So going further and further into conflict with Lebanon, and let's face it, Lebanon hasn't got much of its own army, but there is both Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is a proxy for Iran, and that is known and understood. So you know that if you go into war with Hezbollah, you are going to be starting a war with Iran. I believe there may have been some bombing in Baghdad. There would seem to be some TV pictures. I don't know whether that's the case or whether that was just aerial shots of Baghdad anyway. It was hard to tell. But we are looking at a possible all-out conflagration in the Middle East, of which the end result is unclear as to who anybody comes out of it feeling more secure. I don't think happy is the right term, but more secure than they went into it. Because ultimately, Israel is by far the strongest in terms of its defensive. I mean, you're talking about Iron Dome. They've got, one of the best trained armies in the world. They do have nuclear weapons. I don't know if they've ever admitted that, but everyone knows they do. But they are also surrounded on all sides by states who might get involved in such a conflagration. Some of those states may not have the strongest armies, but they have a fuck ton of money. And if they decide to get involved, they can fund huge armies and huge missile resources and will have no compunction in buying such weaponry from people who will sell them. And frankly, there are enough sellers out there. So I don't, I was, after October the 7th, I knew that something was going to happen. And I thought that Israel had the right to take action. I haven't always been entirely comfortable with some of the actions within Gaza itself. I thought the pushing further and further into what were already displacement camps made it harder and harder to justify. But I absolutely was on board with the initial justification for some sort of action. I find the argument in Lebanon much, much harder. And harder both in strategically, as I say, just fighting a war on two fronts there's a reason we use that as a metaphor for a bad idea. And that I think that the moral case for it is considerably less clear than it was on October the 7th. And I think that that being the case, it makes that other state actors more likely to get involved and feel compelled to get involved. But hell, what do I know? I mean, I'm not a military strategist. I know fuck all about this shit.
So a few points. On the 8th of October, 2023, missiles started coming in from Hezbollah in the north. Ever since then, from Lebanon, ever since then, there have been swathes of Israeli society who have been unable to return to their homes because of that year's worth of rocket fire, of missile fire, of attack. And part of this mission in Lebanon, as I understand it, and the part of trying to with the pages exploding, taking out of Nasrallah, everything else is to try and decapitate Hezbollah so that people can actually return to their homes.
If it ends there, Charlotte, I'll believe you. I'm just not convinced it's going to end there.
I'm just saying what the case is. And that's a really important thing to remember, because I think people have forgotten quite how many people in Israel have been displaced, both in the north and the south. Obviously, the people whose the kibbutzim were who were, attacked and terrorized on October the 7th, they haven't been back in the north. Like, displacement in Israel is a huge issue. I think your point about state actors also is interesting, because of course there's always state actors. That, as you said, Hezbollah, we all know, is a proxy for Iran. We know this. Like, so by definition, by firing missiles into Israel on October the 8th, Iran had already got involved. It's an interesting argument as well, of like, look, you and I are both sort of nervous. Oh, it's all complicated. But I don't know if pacifist is quite the word, but you know what I'm getting
No,
at.
I'm not a pacifist, and that's something I've had to make an active choice about. I think we may have spoken about this before, because I come from a household where one of my parents is a pacifist and the other one isn't. And so it was an active discussion in our family. So I suppose I'm dovish rather than pacifist, but I do believe
I think dovish is a
in
better
action
way.
when necessary.
But my point about raising that is, I think in some cases, particularly if it's not your country directly affected, there's a real capacity to be gung ho about military action. I don't think that reflects either you or I's point of view. But there is perhaps an argument that this stuff now has to be done to sort of lance the boil.
Maybe. And if we find ourselves in a place with fewer boils in 5 years' time, that is a great outcome.
5 years' time,
I'm
that would be horrendous. I
unconvinced
mean, that's
that we
a hell of a
will.
long time.
I just, having watched the fallout from previous Middle East activity, be that Iraq, be that Afghanistan of the 80s, it doesn't, I'm just not convinced that that's the direction this is going in, but it would be nice were that to be true.
I mean, no one. I can't find it in myself to be gleeful about war. I obviously feel very adamantly that Israel, after the atrocities of October 7th, has a very strong reason to self-defense and also to protect itself from future attack.
Yeah, I absolutely buy that. And I buy it, but no, buy that. That sounds
Yeah, I know what you're
wrong. I
getting at,
buy
though.
into that. But I think that where the line is as to what that consists of is probably where we might have slightly different pain points, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I do also think it's very hard for us in the UK to understand quite how embedded in civilian society these terror groups are, and that brings terrible, terrible consequences. I just want to reiterate that. I want, we're going to have another Jewish holiday with hostages trapped underground. We're going to, obviously, I'm horrified and deeply upset by, Palestinian children and fam,
Yeah, and
in
I mean,
Gaza. It's just,
we're going to have
but.
another Jewish holiday with hostages underground, and that is horrific and should never have happened. We are also going to see almost certainly several Muslim holidays with Palestinians who've lost children, families, and living in displacement camps. Neither of these things are right or good or to be glorified. They are both the consequence of, first of all, the action on October the 7th that should never be forgotten. And there is no justification for what happened on October the 7th, and that is the end of that sentence. There is a separate conversation to be had about the long-term problems of the fundamental lack of a long-term solution for the Palestinian state, which has led to further and further entrenchment of military jihadis within that state. And that is a failure of international diplomacy. It's a failure of regional diplomacy. It's a failure of the Israelis. It's a failure of the Palestinians.
Look, I could give you a whole long speech about what I think of the current Israeli political setup. We don't have, you know, we don't have time for that. But, you know, we, you and I both knew once we were seeing the news from last night that we really had to sort of try and navigate what was going on last night, because, you know, as you said, there's been multiple failures. You know, I am someone that does believe in a, still after all of this, still does believe in a two-state solution. I'm not, as I think I've said this to you before on the show, I'm not, I don't know if the mass murder, rape and hostage taking of October the 7th should be the thing that gets you that. But ultimately, I absolutely, you know, I've said for years that it's the only real solution. How practical it becomes, I truly don't know. But, you know, in my, you know, ideal world, that is, of course, what should be. And I've always felt that.
And I mean, you and I are of an age. I mean, I'm of a significantly more age than you. I hasten to point out before you do. But we both were alive and aware of an active IRA, for example.
Quite so, yeah. And particularly because we lived in London.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, we have seen intractable issues which involved at least terrorism on one side be largely, not completely, but largely solved. So one has to take hope from that.
Through diplomacy and negotiation.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I find nothing quite so facile and banal as the phrase, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Because actually, ultimately, yes, you do, because that's where how you end it. When and how and what that negotiation is shaped like and ends up like, those are the questions. But it's a facile thing to say, because ultimately the Good Friday Agreement would never have happened unless somebody was willing to sit down with somebody from the IRA.
Including the Queen ultimately having dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, yeah, you and I... Look, I know quite a bit about this region. I've been there. I've, you know, worked in this.
I mean, you know far, far more about it than I do. And you are probably, I mean, you've got far greater links to one of the sides than I do.
Yeah, and I actually, I don't like, I know why we have to describe it as such, and you and I both have. I don't really like talking about it like a football match, like a football team you support. And I know that's not what you're trying to
But I mean, there are, in a war, there are sides as well as there are in a sports match. But and you know, living in East London, I obviously know people who are Jewish, I know people who are Muslim, I know people who have friends and family on both sides. And so I do find it incredibly hard to navigate.
Sure. Yeah, so we, as I say, we wanted to sort of touch on where we were. I suspect the few days, next few days, are going to be very, very tense and difficult. We will have to see. We'll have to see also, yeah, what action continues in Lebanon, what action Iran continues to take. I think your underlying, when we were planning this, your sort of underlying theme for what it was as it's complicated. And thankfully, you know, you and I don't actually have to solve the Middle East crisis. We
can you imagine?
I shudder to.
Can we solve it with bad puns?
There's been worse ideas. Instead, instead, we can head to Birmingham and try and solve the Conservative Party's leadership woes with bad puns. All four, we're just recording this shortly after all four remaining leadership candidates have taken the stage. That's Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly, Robert Jenrick, and Kirby Badenoch. Right. So they all gave a sort of 20-ish minute speech to conference. Tom Tugendhat was up first, then Cleverly, then Jenrick, and it ended with Kirby Badenoch. Here's my first impressions. I went in expecting and sort of assuming my backing, such that it is, I mean, I'm not a Conservative Party member, I have no say on this, would be for Tom Tugendhat. He sort of seemed like the person that most aligned with me. And I thought he did okay. I thought he did pretty well. And that's his biggest problem. It's just fine. Right?
It felt like a wet rag to me.
It felt very wet. Exactly. Exactly. It was fine. I was in the military. I care about the Conservatives in the country. I'm going to do X, Y, Z better. I'm a bit different because I wasn't in the cabinet. It was fine.
The problem I have with Tugendhat, he must know he's not going to win. And yet he still keeps throwing out this stuff that you kind of know he doesn't believe. And I don't know why he's doing that.
You talk about the ECHR stuff?
Yeah.
So apparently he always says that his view has been long term. I saw a video of him and Steve Baker talking about it. Basically saying, I'd rather not leave. I want to do X, Y, Z to change it. But if I have to, I will.
Yeah, it just feels like he's trying to do a handbrake right turn. And if you believe that the Conservative Party needs to go down a different route, make the case rather than trying to pander.
Yeah,
because I don't think the members are buying it.
And that's a fair point. Yeah, I think this was his last chance to have a real breakthrough moment. He needed his David Cameron versus David Davis moment, and that didn't quite happen.
Oh, so what was that mad introduction? Like, so when I was in primary school...
Oh, where's this going?
We used to have to greet our head teacher, who was lovely, by the way. He was fabulous, fabulous head teacher.
Where is this going?
Every assembly, we had to say, good morning, Mr. Bradshaw. Good morning, all.
Oh, I know where you're going.
And that whole, I didn't hear you bit at the beginning.
Yes,
it
he did.
Felt like I was in school assembly.
I thought it was a bit more like a not great stand-up comedy.
I mean, it was a bit hidey-high, but it felt more like he was the kind of thinks he's cool but isn't head teacher, which I would like to point out that Mr. Bradshaw was cool.
Right, I'm sure he's listening.
Afraid he's passed, but yeah.
Just
he's
to
listening
pause.
Somewhere.
Just to pause on this moment, I was struck, particularly for Tom Tugendhat, which was first up in the morning, how empty that hall was. That was not a full packed out hall.
Oh, I didn't really notice, but I'm sure you're right.
There was a lot. I'm sorry, that was not a buzzing packed out hall. Anyway, so I thought...
Was it more packed for the later speakers?
I think it did
it
get
a bit
busier.
Of an empty hall?
I think it did get a little bit busier. I'd be surprised if it was a full house.
Were they... The order, was that presumably an order that they're polling?
I guess so. That would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, as I say, I thought he needed his David Cameron versus David Davis moment. I don't think that happened. I thought there was nothing bad he did. There was nothing to break through. The best, I thought, was James Cleverly.
So,
who I didn't expect to be the best.
I agree with you, but I was trying really, really hard to watch this through two lenses, watch all of them through two lenses. First of all, the lens of what I think the average person in the country. So taking off my Labour Party activist hat and
sure.
putting on my average voter hat and then putting on my party member hat, but not a Labour Party member. So trying to think like a party member thing.
Sure.
But transposing that to the Conservative Party.
That's quite a lobotomy anyway.
Yeah, tell me about it. Did you mean lobotomy?
Yeah.
Okay, just checking, because you're not usually that rude about party conservatives. It's usually my job. I think that James Cleverly was the one who made the speech that would appeal best to the country by far, head and shoulders. I don't know that Conservative Party members are ready to hear that. In general, when parties have just lost an election, they take their time to get to the point where they're ready to move towards the country rather than away from the country. So I think that the problem any leadership contender in any party has, well, okay, more so in the two big parties. And I can come on to why afterwards if you want me to. But basically, the job of leader of the opposition is to look at the gap between where you are and where the country is and narrow it.
Yeah,
The
you have to bring
job
people, either bring your
of
party or the country with you.
candidate for leader of the opposition is to look at the gap between where you are and where your party is and narrow it. At the point that you have just lost an election, almost by definition, the gap between where your party is and where the country is at its largest. And in so where, I mean, Keir Starmer gets a lot of stick in the Labour Party for having basically run on one platform and completely flipped it and then basically led from a completely different direction, right? He ran on the platform he knew would get him the leadership, and he's led in the way that he knew might win him in the election.
And has been proved, whatever I think of it, he's
And
been
but
proved
he's been
right
proved
twice.
right on both counts, yeah. So the question that I have about Cleverly's speech, which I agree with you, apart from the Oasis line, which I thought was a bit tin-eared, because I think one of the things that people were complaining about was that Oasis tickets were too expensive, and they probably would have liked the government to step in and
Yeah, I
regulate
mean,
that a bit.
yeah, there's an argument if that's the place of government, but yes, I'm sure if there was free Oasis tickets for all policy, it would be very
Yeah.
popular.
But in general, he was talking to the country, but was he doing it 2 months too early? Is the
Interesting question.
question.
Very
And
interesting.
that is the question that I think Tory members are going to have to answer, because if what the Tory members want is their id, then they, because I think what Cleverly absolutely did was get himself into the final two.
Do you?
Yes. I think
At whose
that there,
expense?
well, that's the big question, because I think Tory MPs now are going to have to decide whether the person that they want to put to the membership is Robert Jenrick or Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, they could get rid of both of them.
They
I
could,
agree with
they're
you.
not
It seems
going to.
no, I think that's unlikely.
There will be a right wing candidate, right wing of the Conservative parties are all right wing, obviously. And I thought
I thought I'll jump in.
Jenrick was crap,
I thought he was atrocious.
but I thought Kemi Badenoch was mad.
So a
And I
couple
think I'd rather have crap than mad if I were a Tory MP.
So I thought Robert Jenrick was appalling. I was shocked at how bad it was. It was vacuous. It was just crappy culture war touch points that didn't mean anything.
Well, so was Badenoch.
I'll come on to her in a minute. Just on here, I thought he was really cringe. There was only one line that made me laugh, and I have to confess, I did laugh out loud at this Robert Jenrick line. You are entitled to judge me. He called David Lammy proof that there's a more annoying LBC presenter than James O'Brien. Which did
I
make
mean,
me, that is
yeah, but it's
quite
not true. There are no more annoying LBC presenters. Well, maybe Nick Ferrari.
funny. Anyway, the line made
But
me
yeah.
laugh.
Okay, here's my other question.
Hit me.
Why is Ed Miliband running for the leadership of the Tory Party?
Yes, very
Because
interesting
they
that
all
they.
seem to be running against him.
They mentioned him a lot, didn't they? There was a
I mean,
couple of.
clearly net zero is something that they think that Tory members hate.
Sure. And they don't like, and they think Ed Miliband is a bit of a
And Ed
easy
Miliband is
kicker.
supposed to boyfriend. And he, yeah, he is fairly easily kickable because he was former Labour leader and all of that. So I kind of get it, but
He was mentioned a lot.
he was mentioned a lot.
The other thing before we come on to Kerry Badenoch that I found strategically interesting, and I hope this appeals to you at this point, was they all had to mention three other parties now. They couldn't just target Labour. They obviously had to talk about reform from the right flank, and often they had to talk about the Lib Dems who'd taken a bunch of seats off them.
And I don't think they've nearly reckoned enough with the Lib Dem threat.
No.
I mean, if you just look at the history of the Lib Dems versus Farage-led parties, the fact that we have to say Farage-led parties for a start, shows you where I might be going with this thought. Reform might succeed. They've done a few things in the last few months that show some real impetus towards professionalising properly as a party.
Yep. We'll
They've
probably,
got
I
this
think we'll
new
do a paid
CEO.
show. We'll do a paid show
Sure.
on
But
diving into them.
of those two, I would say that the Tories have an easier chance of getting respect voters back, reform voters back, than
Lib
the Lib
Dem.
Dem voters.
Do
Because
you?
Lib Dem, I do, because I think Lib Dem MPs, they're described as Japanese knotweed. I mean, okay, I wouldn't go into coalition with the Tories again if you want to keep the seats, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. So therefore, they probably are quite likely to keep the seats. And as long as Lib Dems stay away from government, they'll probably keep having a large parliamentary presence.
Yeah, interesting. So I found
And
that
I don't think
interesting.
the Tories have, I don't think the Tories have come to grips with that at all.
No, and I don't think they've actually come to grips with how to sort of navigate not just a tightrope between them and Labour, but how to navigate through multiple parties that can take votes off you. And let's be honest, that is what we saw at the election. We saw a broad support for Labour, but not deep support for Labour. And some of it, not all of it, was anti-Tory stuff, just like some of the Lib Dem votes were anti-Tory stuff.
I mean, this is the thing. I think in two directions, a slight excuse for Labour and a slight problem for Labour, direction in terms of the 34% thing is that people were just going to go out and vote for whichever bloody option got rid of the Tories
In lots of places, yes.
in lots of places. So I think you can probably forgive Labour a few percentage points. And they had a deliberate strategy to lose votes in their stonking majority inner city seats in order to gain a much broader geographical reach. I mean, that was explicit in their strategy. Now, that does mean that they have their own insecurities. And while you might be able to explain that, it does make it harder to govern than 40%, what it just does.
Sure.
However much you've got a parliamentary majority. And I think just psychologically, they are still, it feels like they're still carrying that Ming buzz. But again, I think the Tories have the harder job because they have to convince a whole swathe of electorates that they've changed. But those electorates who all hate them for very different reasons.
Yeah, and for me, after watching these speeches, James Cleverly was the one best equipped to navigate that very difficult space. Just to finish up on Kerry Badenoch, she did the culture war stuff as well. For me, she got the best response in the room, from what I could tell.
Oh, yeah. If she's put to the members, she might well win it. She Liz trussed it up quite a lot, which, you know, did pretty well with the members last time. She, again, the only reason that the Tory party might not do what opposition parties traditionally do is because they've actually had quite a few leadership contests while in power. And as I once said to Liz Truss's speechwriter, the thing with our lot is that we put Jeremy Corbyn in power, in the leadership in opposition. The thing with your lot is you put Liz Truss in government. And that makes a massive difference to how long the tail of that might be.
Call your final two then?
I think it's going to be Jenrick Cleverley, and I think Jenrick will probably edge it.
Because
I think Kemi's burnt her toast a lot with MPs this week. All of the nonsense around maternity pay. I think there were a lot
she's
of
had
MPs
a bad week.
Who were looking for a reason not to vote for her.
Yeah, she's had a bad week. So I think James Cleverley, probably his speech did do enough to get him in.
Yeah.
Maybe the right flank will just get around Robert Jenrick. I thought his actual speech was the worst of all four, but we'll see.
I think it was the worst of all four when I was watching with my country goggles on. When I was watching with my what does the party faithful want to hear goggles on, I would say probably not. I mean, I think he did what was needed for that particular audience.
Just before Kevin Bedenock came on stage, an interesting story broke on Bloomberg, which says she's running her leadership campaign from the house of a donor, a wealthy donor called Neil Record. It used to be run the IA, he's a city currency trader. And I think, so obviously this cut is interesting compared to the criticism of Keir Starmer, obviously a spokesperson for her, so she's done nothing wrong. It's kind of an interesting developing story. I wonder how much of this stuff will come out.
I'd be more concerned about the connection to the IAA than anything else. I mean, frankly, they're the ones that masterminded the Liz Truss strategy.
Emma, where can people keep up with you?
You can read my newsletter, which is Hard Thinking on the Soft Left. And if you live in the Milton Keynes or wider Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire area...
Oh, blimey.
You can come and see my play on October the 17th, Four Weigh-ins and a Funeral, which will be appearing as part of the Taking the Stage Festival Day 2 at the Milton Keynes Gallery.
Wonderful plug. I look forward to hearing about it. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across social media. Head over to theaddition.net for my blog, newsletter, other podcast stuff. The best way you can support this show and the best way to get all the stuff from Emma and I is to head over to patreon.com/housecommentspodcast. You get extra paid for only content there, and you get both of our paid newsletters as well for a mere £5 a month. We're basically ripping ourselves off. So head over there and be part of
to ourselves.
Quite. Head over there and be part of it. We'll see you next week.